Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to Season 4 of the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Abimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy, a global consulting firm whose main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. My son, Max Abimbola, is co-host of the podcast with me, and he's a first-year computer science student at Newcastle University. Now, as you'll all know if you're regular listeners, Max usually interviews with me as much as he can, but unfortunately, he's got a deadline with some coursework, and he can't join us today, which I think is a fair enough excuse. But I promise you that Max will be back again very, very soon. Now, today, I'm really, really thrilled to be interviewing Tim Hughes. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to it.
It's just so wonderful that we've been able to carve out the time. I'm always very conscious when I ask people to find an hour in their calendars that it can be a really big ask for those who are particularly busy. So I'm really, really grateful for your time, Tim.
You and this is something I would make time for, so.
Oh, thank you so much, Tim. So, Tim, we've known each other for several years now. Our paths have crossed in different capacities. I think last time around, you were interviewing me, if I recall correctly.
I did, on my podcast, yes.
Yes, in the middle of the notorious first wave in 2020.
Oh, 2 years ago or something.
Yes, it was a long time ago now. But our wider audience may not be aware of just how phenomenal you are, Tim. So would you mind introducing yourself to our audience and telling us all a little bit more about you?
So I wrote a book back in 2016. It was released in 2016, yes, called Social Selling Techniques to Influence Buyers and Changemakers. And it's been a bestseller. And I run a business called DLA Ignite. And what we do is we transform sales and marketing teams to use social to sell. And in effect, we have reinvented sales and marketing. And this isn't just a training course or anything like that. We change people's lives. And one of the things that saddens me is that at the moment, because of COVID, we're not able to actually do things face to face. But I've had people come up to me and hug me, say to me, you know, you've changed my life. And it's an amazing feeling. It's actually quite addictive to change and for people to feel like that. And that's my background. I'm a salesman by trade. And, you know, I've been in sales for 25 years. I'm selling mainly business to business, enterprise. And that's my background.
So just delving a bit deeper then, Tim, into how your career got started. You know, how did you land in sales? What was it that drove you towards a career in sales? We'd love to find out more.
My academic career was actually one of, my parents were told for me to leave school that I would have been 15 and that I should get a job where I didn't need to write. My brother had gone into the sixth form and done A-levels and had made a bit of a hash of it. And the expectation was that I wasn't quite clever enough for A-levels, so I should leave and get a job. And this was during when Margaret Thatcher was in power and we had a massive recession and there was no jobs. And I went to technical college and I did an OND in technology, which was mainly general engineering. And then I went on and did electronic engineering. My father was working at the BBC as a sound engineer. And there was an expectation that I would follow probably in his path. And what I always found when I was doing work was I tended to find the maths and the physics and the science easier. And then I found that the electrical, electronic engineering type things I found easier. So I did that and I went to poly rather than university. Of course, round about that time, the IT industry was taking off. And they were recruiting all kinds of people. I'd say they were recruiting any old people. But I got a job at a company called Standard Telephone and Cables, which is part of ITT, which doesn't exist anymore. And then I went and worked for ICL, which is the first UK computer company. Again, that doesn't exist anymore. It's now part of Fujitsu. Like a lot of people, I just got on this conveyor belt of education and then went and got a job. And I actually pretty much, I think it was the first interview at STC. It was the first interview and they just offered me the job. And then when I was at ICL, I was in a technical role and I thought, there's all these people that were probably my age now who've been doing this technical stuff for years, and this isn't me. And I could see that I'd be sitting in the office and these people would turn up in what looked like really nice cars. And in those days, the mobile phones were like really trendy. They're these big brick things. So I said, what do they do? And they said, they're salespeople. I said, so how do I do that? And they said, oh, well, if you go to HR, you'd probably be able to get a job working with one of them as a salesman's dog's body type thing. So that's what I did. So I was working with four salespeople who were in their 40s and learned a lot. When I was, 20, 24, 25, I wanted to go into sales. And ICL said, you're not going to go into sales until you're 28, 29. So I left and went to work for a small software company. And then it's kind of gone on from there. Like a lot of people that probably come on here, they kind of fell into it.
Yeah, that's very much been the trend that we've seen, Tim, certainly with career paths, with a few sort of rare exceptions, like, you know, obvious things like medicine. We've interviewed a number of medical students and doctors. And for them, it's a very prescribed route. And you don't apply to medical school unless you have the intention of becoming a doctor.
There's a lot of people that provide advice around, you know, follow your passion. And I would say that, you know, I carried on doing the things that's from school that I found easy. And, you know, you kind of just follow that path. And then in terms of, you know, when I was in my 40s, I realized that I didn't want to sell accounting systems for the rest of my life. And my manager actually said to me, you need to get into social media. And this was 11 years ago this April. It's 11 years since I've been on Twitter this April. And I just found it really fascinating to get the whole thing about social media. And then what I wanted to do was actually realized I wanted to work in it. The company I was working for at the time very kindly paid for me to go on a blogging course. And when I was on that blogging course, the person taking it said, you need to work out what you want to be famous for. Because if you're going to blog, you need to blog about a subject. I was sitting there and it did feel like a lightning bolt hit me. It was just one of those things where I just went, I'm going to be famous for social selling. And I've built a career based on that ever since. I left that company. They very kindly made me redundant, which gave me the funding for the first year for the startup. And same with my business partner, Adam Gray. And we've now been doing it for 6.5 years. So it's one of those things where people say you need to do the job that you do needs to be kind of what you're passionate about or what is your hobby. I am extremely passionate about what I do. And so it doesn't ever feel like work. And that's kind of, you know, those two things that I would say to people, yeah, follow your passion. And sometimes it's not about the money. You know, I'm in a startup. I could earn more by going back into corporate life, but then I'm not here running my own company. I'm setting the strategy. I'm living and dying by decisions that I make. And that's very thrilling. And I find it very inspirational as well.
Yes, that's such a good tip. Very, very strong tip that I often share with my mentees when they ask, you know, they're a bit lost, they didn't know which direction to go in. Playing to your strengths, which tends to be what you enjoy doing. If you're good at something, that tends to be your strength. You're going to enjoy it. And, you know, another very strong tip then to our younger listeners who are in year 12, year 13. We've got a very large cohort of sixth formers, some still at university, like my son, Max. You know, just think about this. Think about how you can play to your strengths because, you know, it's not always about the money. And that's also something that has come up several times. I just love these themes that are coming through, Tim, around really following your passion and also how a career is a very flexible thing, isn't it? It doesn't have to be too prescribed.
I got made redundant from Capgemini and I got a payoff and it was enough to do an MBA. So I actually investigated doing an MBA at that point. So I would have been in my late 30s. And there's nothing wrong in, I think, in actually deciding, you know, going through school and doing a degree and then going out to work and then deciding, well, I might go back into education again. Because what you'll do if you do something like an MBA in your 30s or something, you'll take the experience, the work experience that you have into that education and you'll learn things as long as you come out of it and you apply the education that you've got. I mean, I know someone at my previous company, I paid for his MBA. We, as a company, we pay for MBAs and I paid that. And I said, whatever you do, don't come back and do the same job you did. And that's what he did. So now he's doing exactly the same thing that he was doing before with an MBA. And it was like, he came to me saying, I want to do an MBA because I want to progress, but he's not actually progressed. But my point being is, you know, education is one of those things that don't be afraid to go back into education and retrain.
Yes, very, very important to keep learning, which is another thing that I think when a lot of more junior professionals look at senior leaders, they forget that actually the ability to keep learning and being open to allowing that learning to shape your path, importantly, is absolutely critical to success going forward.
Yeah, I remember reading the Mindset book by Carol Dweck about fixed mindset and growth mindset. And I was just completely blown away with it. I mean, I bought a copy for all my board and my family as well. And they probably just threw it in the bin. But I was just so blown away about how the difference between the fix and the growth and the fact that we actually move between the two. We're not actually gifted or whatever with one or the other, but to actually recognize the attributes. So, for example, one of my team was training someone recently and they kept saying, yeah, I know that, I know that, I know that, I know that, I know that. And actually saying I know that is actually a classic comment from someone with a fixed mindset. Because if you've got a growth mindset, what you'll do is you'll listen to what the other person, even if you do actually know what the person's saying, the person may actually say something, I didn't realize that, or I didn't ever think about that. And it's so crucial. And I think the way that the world is accelerating, I watched my parents, they got behind the IT curve and then had to go through an awful lot of work to try and claw back the ability to know how to use PCs and things like that. And I'm still the IT help desk for them. You can fall behind so quickly.
Yes, it's really, really important to be really proactive around these learning opportunities. And Tim, I'd love to get a sense, though, of some of the challenges that you face along this path. I mean, I'm sort of reading a little bit into some of the experiences, you know, being made redundant, which is never a great thing, really, in the immediacy of it, although later on. It can be and often ends up being a great opportunity. But would you mind sharing some of those challenges with our audience, please? And importantly, how you managed to overcome those challenges, Tim?
Yeah, I think that the redundancy thing, as always, quite often when you get made redundant, it's a big shock. But actually, as long as you treat that as an opportunity, I think, in a way, what happened with the Capgemini was I walked straight into another job. And so the payoff I got, I didn't go on an MBA, it went off and pay my mortgage off. So, you know, it's one of those things where you go, well, I'm in a new job now and I'm mortgage free. Well, you know, rock and roll. So it wasn't so bad. The second redundancy I had has paid for the first year. You know, we've never had to go out to a VC and actually borrow any money. We're able to run the business ourselves. I was very lucky in the last corporate role I did to do not just a management, but a leadership training course. And I highly recommend anybody that gets an opportunity to do that, because it's provided me with the skills that I've needed to be the CEO of an organization. I mean, there's so many things you learn about when you set up a company, like how to be a director and bank accounts and what on earth do accountants do. But actually having the skill to know how to manage people. I was on a call earlier today. Every Monday we have a training session internally. And we do that because it brings everybody together. I run a virtual remote company. So I have people from New York, London, Ipswich, Peru, all kinds of people from different places. And I was sitting there because I knew that I was coming onto this. And there's such a wonderful bunch of diverse people. One of the challenges I'm coming to is that the fact that each of them needs to be managed in a different way. And, you know, I have one guy on the team and he always sits there like this, just on his Zoom. He never moves. What used to happen was that you'd get something, you'd discuss it, you'd make an agreement, and then, well, what about this, this, and this? And you'd go, well, if we'd known those things, we wouldn't come to that agreement. So you then have to unpick it. So now I know that what we do is before any agreement is you say, what do you think? And he looks at these things through a completely different lens. He never volunteers it. And just having that, I always say to him, it's actually you know, looking at things through a different lens is actually really important. But we have such a diverse team, but it's about knowing. One of those things I've had to learn is about, okay, what do I need to do to get the best out of one of the best trainers and coaches that we have in the country? And, you know, what do I need to do to get the best out of my business partner, Adam, who tends to be, I'm going to tell you about something and I'm going to keep telling it to you until you agree with me type people. So, you know, you've got all these different people. And that's one of the things that I think is so key about leadership, is that we have weaknesses. And it's so important to recruit people who have those things as strengths, and then actually making sure that you're doing your best. You'll never be perfect, but doing your best to pull the best out of those people. And that's one of the learnings that I've had over the last 6.5, 7 years of being the CEO of a company.
There's certainly a lot to be said for playing to collective strengths. And of course, that comes from a place of having a lot of self-awareness, frankly, yes. As a leader. You need to be very self-aware. And I've got a very, very good picture there. And it's all about adaptable leadership and all these wonderful things that we've all had to do throughout the pandemic and throughout lockdowns.
Well, it is. It's about making sure that you're asking questions and the right questions. And sometimes, I think sometimes they probably think I'm stupid because I ask what quite often, you know, what would be deemed a stupid question. But actually what I'm trying to do is actually find out what the answer is. I have a millennial on the team and she will always start at, so who knows about this? And what happens is you get someone saying, well, I think I know something. And it's like, just say you don't know anything about it. Because this is about finding out what that person knows and let them share. And then you know, so even if it's something that we all know something about, just say you don't know, because it's about getting that person to shine. But it is, it's about, leadership is a strange and lonely place sometimes. It's always about trying to get the best out of people. The other thing I've learned is about toxicity. We had someone who was toxic and we never dealt with it. We spotted the toxicity because it meant we recruited the person because there was a gap and we needed to recruit. Adam and I could have worked harder. And we didn't. We brought the person in and it was then toxic. Then they were toxic from day one. Then it took us 18 months. We should have dealt with it. We shouldn't have recruited them and we should have dealt with it. And my recommendation always when people say, is there one thing in leadership that you've learned? And I say, cut toxicity, get it out, because all your employees know that it's toxic and they want to know why you're not doing anything about it. And what you need to do is, unfortunately, it's got to go. Yeah. And you need to cut it out and it's got to go. And, you know, letting people go is not the easiest thing, and especially toxic people. But it's, you know, you've got to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's certainly, gosh, tell me about it. Been there several times, unfortunately, with some of the teams I've had to manage. And I'd love to get a sense, though, of what a typical day would look like for you, Tim. Because you've already mentioned that on a Monday, you always prioritize having a training session with the whole of the team. But what does a typical day look like? Do you wake up at the same time every day, for example, and have a set pattern? What does it look like for you?
I do. I did a course where they, I think it was like an early, it would have been an early NLP type course, where they were saying things like habits are actually really good because you don't have to think. So it's a bit like the fact that Mark Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs wear the same clothes every day, because that means that they don't have to think about what am I going to wear. So Monday, Wednesday and Friday, I decided back in 2020, if I was going to catch COVID, I was going to be as fit as I could be if I caught it. So I started running. So I've been running 3 times a week. I do 5K on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. And it was really difficult, like any change of habit, it's really difficult to begin with. And then, I mean, you know, this morning I got up and went, I've got to go running. I've got to go running. And I find it clears the head. It gives me time to think. You know, I can pick themes and it's a really great thinking time. Every day is different because we're a small business. So we're constantly looking for new clients because new clients enable us to bring cash into the business. So we're constantly managing that and managing the cash flow. We see it really is important that we create this environment of training. We're a training and coaching company. Therefore, what we need to do is make sure that the team are the high watermark. So what we do is that we train people how to use social to ultimately get conversations with people. And so the thing about social selling is that people think it's selling on social, and it's not, because no one likes to be sold to. And actually what it is, it's about creating an environment where people in effect walk towards you and have a conversation. That's what we see as being transformational. And one of the things that we do is that we create internal training environments where people can come along, and either Adam and I will train them so for example, I've just built a new Twitter course. So last Thursday, I trained our team on Twitter, all the people that wanted to go on it. And now we're in a position that we've got a 2-2.5 hour course that we can actually train people with. Or what we do is that we use the time for people to come and ask questions. So we've just taken on a new partner. He came on, he had a whole list of questions and asked for 30 minutes. So what if I do this? What happens if I do this? And what happens if I do this? And we use the collective experience of everybody to then coach. So it's kind of social learning. And of course, with that, when he asks a question, it's probably something that everybody else was thinking anyway. So we're able to do that from a training perspective. There's a number of people that I have one-to-ones with. That's either from a sales perspective, as a sales leader, or as a leader in terms of them looking to see what they need to do and where they're going. I run my own podcast. You've been a guest on, which takes time in terms of, you know, I had a call with someone today, which is, I always do a prep call. I know that you're free forming. I always do a prep call, partly because I haven't met the people before. And sometimes, because I just get, someone will say, you need to talk to this person. And I'll look at their social profiles and I'm thinking, I don't know what I can ask them. And then there was a person today and I just couldn't understand what they did. And she's completely transforming training. She's democratizing training by producing training courses that anybody can, as long as you've got access to the internet. You can be in India, you can be in Bangladesh, you can be in Argentina, you can go on them for free. And of course, what this does is that this is empowering people. And, you know, you don't need to go to a fancy university with loads of money to go on the court. She's putting about Apple products and Google products. And gradually what that does is a bit like TED Talks when it first started, which is give people instantaneous knowledge. And that's what she said. She says, I'm a teacher. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach people across the whole of the world. That's an amazing sense of empowerment. And that's what we're going to talk about. But I didn't know that from just looking at a Twitter profile.
There's just so much that you're saying that really aligns with the theme of Women's History Month. You know, this episode will be published in March, and we're doing a special series where we're really drawing out specifically themes around breaking the bias, because that's what the theme is. And so much of what you've described already has been about that. I mean, for example, I would imagine that with the concept of selling, the idea of social selling, as it were, you'd have had to overcome a lot of what people would have had in terms of their own inbuilt biases about what that actually looks like and how can we do it? And is it just me pinging a message to someone on LinkedIn after I've connected with them? I mean, talk us through that and how you see bias might play a part in breaking down some of those barriers.
I deal with bias every day, because usually what happens is that if we go into an organization, marketing block us. And, you know, we always have a debate internally. So what we can do is we can get you more leads cheaper, but you're going to block us. But they do. And that's often because we've got people there that have been to university 20 years ago. They learned marketing as a craft back then, which is quite often meant that you spent loads of money on advertising. And what they haven't done is they've kept their heads down and they've carried on doing what they were doing, but they haven't seen some of the changes that have taken place. You know, when we started the business, you know, the internet, social media, and mobile had revolutionized the world. You switch on the TV, you switch on the news, it's about what's happened on social media. And it's changed the world, and it's changed the world of society, and it's changed business. Barack Obama, his first presidential election came about through the power of social media. He built a groundswell and a community. And that was over 10 years ago. Same with the Arab Spring. And what's happened is that with COVID, that's just accelerated. You know, there were so many things that I was told, or we were being told in March 2020 when we were first went into lockdown, could not be done over the internet. You know, church, piano lessons, doctor's appointments, we were told they all had to be face-to-face. Now you see the doctor over Zoom, piano lessons are over Zoom, and you can go to church over Zoom because we've proven that it can be done. And that's some of the changes that people don't seem to realize, is that the mass change that's taken place in society. So yeah, we get a lot of bias where people, and a lot of people just put their fingers in their ears, because I think a lot of it is to do with belief systems. I'm a Liverpool football fan. I mean, you can put facts in front of me to tell me how wonderful Manchester United is, and I will not believe you, because it's not part of my belief system. And I think that's one of the cases that we get with, certainly we talk to a lot of people and they're not interested in hearing from us, even though we can do it better, cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, bias is such a powerful thing. And sort of moving swiftly on from that, Tim, and something that is actually related, because you do need to have an element of privilege to be able to exercise bias. I mean, whether it's conscious or unconscious, it comes from a position of relative strength that you can actually exercise this bias and not feel that there are going to be any consequences for you, for example. So I'd love to get a sense of what your understanding is of privilege, first of all, and how you've seen that playing out in different settings, possibly through the bias lens also.
Yeah, privilege is, you know, I'm white, I'm male, I'm middle class. You can't get more privileged than me. And I understand that. And I think that, you know, I grew up in a very, very white environment and a very male environment, because, you know, I was born in 65. You know, my mother passed. She passed the 11 plus a year early, but she wasn't allowed to go to grammar school because she wasn't the daughter of a solicitor or doctor or of a dentist. And what they trained her for was to be a secretary. So they gave her typing skills. And, you know, she subsequently ended up doing a degree and that later on in life. So there's lots of, I think there's lots of inbuilt biases. And some of the things that we have to do, you know, There's inbuilt biases that I have to look around, and there's some of them that we have to, you know, we're never going to be in a situation where we're not going to have any biases at all. We come across it every day because of the fact that, you know, as I said, these people went to university 20 years ago and they see things as they were, not as they are. I mean, the classic example I always have is using Uber. It's a great example of how the world has changed, that you can just use an app to call a taxi. You haven't got to phone anybody up. You haven't got to stand in a queue. Back in 2019, I spent some time in San Francisco and then went to Seattle and Uber everywhere. My partner and I, we got the train to Vancouver and we got out the train station and we said, so we'll get Uber, and Uber just sits there and whirs. And when we said to someone, so how do you get a taxi? He said, you join the queue. And we went, you what? They said, you got to join the queue. And it was like one of those things where you suddenly go back in time and you go, you know, there's lots of Uber variants as well. But this is one of the ways that mobile has changed the world. And I think sometimes we, because we've never experienced it, we don't therefore necessarily see that it's a problem or we've seen the change. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
You really, really have, because you've opened in so many interrelated themes there, leveraging sort of the concept of bias, Tim, and then linking that to privilege. I love the example about Uber, because again, I would also have made the same assumption, right? I mean, it wouldn't have, I can't even think of the last time when I actually had to stand in a queue the way that you'd have had to.
I know, you've got to stand in a queue? What?
I haven't done that for 10 years.
North America, it's a line, but... But yeah, but it's like, and it's raining and the queue's in the rain. God. And it's like, yeah, that's the way we do it here. That's how we roll here in Vancouver.
It's like, Tim.
We ended up getting a bus because I'm not going to stand in the queue. We actually decided to get our mobiles out and work out how to get a bus, but because part of the intellectual challenge of it, but it was like, come on. And I think that's applicable across a whole bunch of parts of society where if you're not used to it, during one of the lockdowns, we live walkable into Kingston upon Thames. And we just hadn't noticed that the world had gone through apps. We're coming out of a lockdown. You were allowed to go into a restaurant of sorts. But what happened was you just couldn't just turn up. You had to book through an app. And we'd missed this. And so we walked into Kingston, because normally you can just walk into any restaurant and just get and open the door, walk in and get a table. Now you've got to book through an app. And of course, when we spoke to Luke, who's my partner's now 26-year-old son, he's like, duh, like everything goes through an app. You know, you can just, you know, I said earlier on, the world moves so fast that just within a couple of weeks, the whole world had transferred to the only way that you could get a table at a restaurant was to use an app. And that's the speed of how things happen. And you can so easily fall behind.
That's such a good example around technology. And I really wish Max was here because that's his bag and he'd be so effusive with his enthusiasm around, you know, apps and all the applications there. But when we last spoke, Tim, we were right in the middle of the first wave. And
yes,
it would have been around the time that George Floyd was murdered. And we all remember what that was like and the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and so on. But there was a lot being said at the time about allyship, of course, and what that would look like and what does that mean. And I would love to get a sense from you, Tim. What is your understanding of allyship? And again, do you have any examples that you can draw on where you've seen that work well and indeed where it hasn't worked so well?
George Floyd, it's another technology thing. If George hadn't been videoed dying, he would have been just another statistic. You know, the fact that you had that in front of you on the TV, here is a person who is dying. And these people are not empathetic or sympathetic in the way that they're dealing with this person. And nobody should have been in a situation where they died like that. I think the Black Lives Matter was an amazing thing because it became global. Again, using technology. You know, we went from one thing happening in the States, the next minute we're knocking down statues in Bristol, slave trade statues. And that was so powerful. I read some things on LinkedIn about allyship as being bad. And I'm white. It's not for me to make decisions about what Black people think in terms of whether it's good or bad. All I want to do is I feel that I have an important role to play in the world, which is to make the world a better place. And that means that quite often I have to do things to intervene to actually make sure that the world becomes a better place. I'll give you an example. I said to my business partner, we don't have enough Black people in our company. It was the classic, well, they're not applying. And I said, I'm not going to stand for that. We need to have diversity in our business. And the meeting today, but it just bloody proved it that we need the diversity is just brilliant within an organization. I said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to proactively find people of different ethnic backgrounds, whether it's women or men or whatever, and I'm going to recruit them. and I'm going to get off my backside and actually do it. You know, some people will say, well, you shouldn't do that, or you should do that. I just thought it was the right thing to do. And what it did for us was it completely changed our business in terms of the ability to have this diversity of opinion. And it was the right thing to do. You know, I remember sitting at a conference in London, and this guy came and sat down with me. He said, because there was no seats, he said, can I sit there? I said, yeah, sure. Then we got talking. And he was telling me about he was setting up a company and stuff like that. So I said, well, look, you know, anytime you want any questions, set up a call with me and we'll have a chat. So, I mean, it wasn't exactly a mentorship, but it was, you know, I can help you. I run a business. And I said, there's a lot of people out there that will try and stitch you up. And I'll tell you what you can do to avoid that. And I think it's just about trying to do the right thing. And if that means I have to proactively, opportunities is about doors. Are they open or closed? Sometimes you've got to open the door. I did a questionnaire recently. I'm in the Chartered Management Institute, and they did a questionnaire on ability and disability and getting non-able-bodied people into the business. And my responses were, well, let's do something about it. So one of my partners, we actually use our skills to get people that have left the army into work. We have a guy who's ex-service, and he says that this current training to get people into business and how to use LinkedIn to get a job is shocking. So he's actually bidding for a number of contracts that will come up, and he's actually helping people to do that. So I basically said to the CMI, well, why don't we run a, if you're saying you're running this questionnaire, which means that your people are finding it difficult to getting to work, well, let's do something about it. Let's give them the skills that they need to do this. And I pointed out that we actually have a company that is doing this. So I said, there's no reason why we can't spin something up and help other people in other different areas. My point being is that I just think it's the right thing to do it. My dad would be proud of me, which is one of the drivers. My father's been retired 30 years. He has dementia. He used to work at the BBC, and we had an email from an ex-colleague who was a retirement age. And he said, I had 40 years, great service off the back of what my dad had taught him. And I remember this is, he retired 30 years ago. I remember there was a number of people in the BBC who were trans. So they were basically men and they went through the process of becoming women. And I remember Robert used to come to dinner with us, and then Alice came to dinner with us. And I remember Alice saying to my dad that she was amazed that, you know, when she became Alice, there were so many people that basically took a step back, but my father took a step forward. And if you think about it, you know, when I got divorced, there were certain friends that took a step back and certain friends that took a step forward. And we get this in certain areas of our life. It's so important that we do the right thing. You know, my dad did this 30, 40 years ago when, you know, someone going through a sex change 30, 40 years ago, the bravery that they must have had to actually do that is just unthinkable, the bravery. People didn't want to work with people from an Asian background. And he volunteered to do, because he was a sound guy. He did it, so he did all of the sound. He got invited to Ravi Shankar's 40th birthday party. I've got tapes of Ravi Shankar from, because I've got my dad's tapes. You think about him doing that. I said, okay, so I'm going to do that as well. I live in a different environment and a different world, where there is, you know, we're at least starting to see some equality taking place in the world, especially in the world of entertainment, which is kind of one of the world views that we have. But we've got, as individuals, as a white male, middle class, privileged person, I have a role to play in making sure that everybody basically comes up to a particular level. I just think it's something, and I'm banging my heart with my fist.
Tim, you have no idea how compelling, rich, emotionally. I mean, the heart and mind connection that you've built with all these examples. You know, you've woven in really, really elegantly the fact that allyship is all about action, that there are elements of both the business case for being a proactive ally and also the moral case is the right thing to do. You've woven in the concept of role modeling, how important that was, and all the examples your father set and how progressive he was in his day and continues to be, really. And I know that you've explained he's got dementia, but his legacy lives on is the point I'm trying to make. And that's what then spurred you on to do what you're doing. You know, you've owned up to your privilege and you're using that privilege.
I'm glad you've put names to it. It's a bit like, you know, when you're first in the physics class and someone drops the drops something, and then again they say that's gravity, and you go, all right, okay, I didn't know it had a name, it just things just dropped. But yeah, I mean, I kind of just put this sort of stuff together, but if you put names to it, I mean, that's interesting.
It's amazing. And then for me, that just is so authentic when that's the case. You know, I don't get the sense, you knew roughly which questions I was going to ask, but I just let my guests talk. And it's just wonderful what you've just shared. You know, so for those of you who are in positions of influence like Tim, and you're thinking, what difference can I possibly make? You know, the whole point of these podcast discussions is that you can make a difference. You know, yes. You do need to be proactive. And I just love as well, you know, the way that you've already woven in, you know, the benefits of diversity and why inclusion matters. You've given many examples of that already. But I'd love, before we say goodbye to our audience, Tim, if you could share with us why it is that diversity and inclusion are so important to you.
Part of it actually is selfish, which is that there's no way that Adam, my business partner, and I know the answers to all the questions. We've already agreed that I have weaknesses. So I need to bring people in that can actually be the strengths to those weaknesses. And I think if you do an investigation, I remember during the leadership course that I did, they took certain CEOs. So the CEO that I was working for had a particular, was well known to be weak at certain things. And then they said, no, so he was really weak at financial planning, accountancy. So he hired one of the toughest CFOs that there is in Silicon Valley. And, you know, you went through and you could see that actually the thing that's clever about him is that he recognized those weaknesses and then actually hired to actually get that support. And what I want to do is I think that diversity for me is so important. And I put a comment on LinkedIn just this week, which is the world doesn't need another Tim Hughes. We don't. We've already got one. What we need is lots of other people that can come on and actually provide lots of different comments. And better still, actually say, no, Tim, you're wrong. And for me to go, oh, yeah, I am. Yeah. And so diversity for me is about, it's just such a strength. It's such a competitive advantage. We have a client where all the board is white. And they're all from some, I don't know, certain, they're friends of, and some, I don't understand the, is it fraternities in certain universities?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't really understand it. But they're all part of this interconnected thing. And it's like, God, you guys are missing out on so much. When I went out and I basically decided to go out, it completely transformed the organization for the better. And we have just got some amazing people who, again, have come on a journey. And it's just, I'm sitting there like sending my notes using on Slack to Adam as his meeting's going on. I'm going, aren't they just wonderful people? I'm not just saying that, but because of the diversity that we have and for people to challenge you as well.
Which is exactly the kind of answer we wish for from all our guests, Tim. There is, trust me, nothing that you've said has been not the right thing to say. It's just been absolutely heartwarming. I love what you said about how the world
Tim
doesn't
Hughes.
Need...
We don't need another... The world doesn't need another Tim
not
Hughes.
Not the Tim Hughes. But I, for one, am very, very grateful that we do have you, Tim.
So thank you very much. We only
have the one, but I'm very grateful, Tim, so much for this conversation we've had. It's just been mind-blowing.
Thank you
so much for your time. And with that, everyone, having had the most inspiring conversation with Tim, honestly, he really has blown my mind. Unfortunately, we need to wrap things up this time around, but thank you so much for supporting Max and I with this Mother-Son podcast. We could never have imagined we would be where we are now in season 4. We found out earlier today that we now have over 5,500 downloads, something that we could never have thought in a million years. So please keep rating, liking, sharing, doing all that you're doing to the HR teams that I know, been emailed by several HR directors to say that they are studying specific episodes and using them as case studies. Really grateful that you're finding so much value from this podcast series. And I look forward very much indeed to my next truly inspiring conversation with yet another amazing leader, just like Tim Hughes. Thanks very much, everyone, and goodbye for now.